adulthood and see their own grown children growing again around them, and everything is very rosy and pleasant. But they have never expected the child to be more than it is. Of course, it is a little peculiar and unique and wonderful because it is their grandchild. But that is about the extent of it. Now, when we go out with people who are grown up physically, and they go babbling along like five-year-old children, we say, oh, I can't waste my time with people like this. Therefore, we begin to get more and more miserable as the hours go by. Then one of these individuals comes up with a tremendous idea that they would like an evening of bridge, and the scholar departs in a state of profound misery, or sits in a corner and pouts. Now, this represents simply lack of insight. It is a very definite fact that reasonable people, intelligent people, do not expect to be continually in the presence of great and important occasions. Really thoughtful persons can quietly accept what they know other people to be, just as we know what children are going to be. But because we are short-sighted, we think that these people have to be grown up because of 40 or 50 years old. This has nothing to do with it. Just as the same situation is that these people may be saying, I don't see why this other person has to be so magnificently aloof and superior because he's only the same age that we are. The different points of view. But actually, the person with insight, knowing the kind of world he lives in, doesn't expect another kind of world. If he insists on having another kind of world, he can perhaps take advantage of interplanetary travel a little later. But he's here. He knows in his heart the kind of world he lives in, but he resents it every time he meets it. This is not good. If we do not expect too much, we may be pleasantly surprised occasionally. But if we expect the unreasonable, we will be perpetually disappointed. Therefore, there are wonderful privileges in this life. Simply to relax, to enjoy a situation without feeling that every occasion in life must have monumental significance. Perhaps what we need most is a good sleep, and perhaps we can get that socially. I have a friend who was a genius at sleeping with his eyes wide open and had a most intelligent expression on his face. This was sheer genius. Very often, we go out to share some minor or light social experience, and we are under such tension when we leave to join this experience that we require either alcohol or something else to let us down, or else we expect the evening to be the same tempo of continual pressure, and if it isn't, we fall apart. There is a real genius in being able to simply relax where the situation permits. There is also great skill in realizing that we can all learn much more by keeping our mouths shut than any other way. Sometimes it's very difficult to spend a quiet evening while some bore is telling what he thinks. But if we open our mouths, someone else will say there are two bores telling what they think. If we are quiet and use our analytical faculties, we may learn a great deal from the most stupid remarks. We may also enrich and enlarge our understanding of people and of human nature. And there's this blessed and wonderful situation that when someone else is talking, we do not have to. And usually we're a great success if we don't. I know people come in the office once in a while to discuss their problem. And they talk for an hour. Never a chance do I get to put a single word in. At the end of the hour, they jump up, pump my hand enthusiastically, and said, you'll never know how much you've helped me. So sometimes we also serve by keeping quiet. We also can gain a great deal of poise and relaxation, and if it becomes too difficult, we can retire into a quiet meditation until the fracas is over. There is no need to become involved in these things. There is no need to live in a state of tension due to being insulted by somebody else's lack of intelligence. There is no need for any of these pressures. They are simply pressures, usually, of a person who is so anxious to correct somebody else's mistakes that he has no chance to find his own faults and do anything about them. So relax. This means that insight will help us continually to relax. This does not mean that we accept what is not true. But we realize that there is no value in being like Don Quixote and simply lancing windmills. The problem is to discover who we can help, when and how. And for the rest of the time, keep a vigilant watch upon the things that happen, in order that we may learn as much as we can from them and be distracted as little as possible by them. So that we quiet out these problems, smooth them down, we will find that a great deal of our lack of relaxation is simply due to the fact that we fight back at things when a victory means nothing in the first place, because nothing is going to be won when we try to reason with an unreasonable person or support a cause which the other person is not even interested in considering. This quiets things down. Therefore, we can say that integration, to a measure, is a continual state of relaxed poise. It isn't an artificial thing. It isn't something that we simply put on. It's the fact that we can live comfortably in the presence of things we don't always agree with, or in situations which perhaps we would not want to have as a permanent fixture. But just as we adjust without question to weather and climate, knowing that we can do nothing about these things, so the temperaments of people in a social structure are like weather and climate. We either accept them or we don't accept them. And if we fight against them, we simply create more and more tension. It is perfectly possible, therefore, to use the things that happen to encourage our own integration, so that we can finally come to a comparatively happy situation. The critic works a lot of tension on himself because he is criticizing his own society. He is criticizing the environment in which he exists. The skeptic loses all the strength that comes from the growth of certainties within himself. The cynic loses all of the goodness or the warmth of life by trying to see something wrong in everything. Instead of assuming that everything is wrong, the simplest thing to assume is the correct thing, that each thing is what it is. That underneath the surface of life, there are these patterns that forbid any person from acting inconsistent with the dominating pressure of his own temperament. Therefore, if he has a certain kind of temperament, we either like it or we do not like it. If we like it, we renew or continue an association of friendship. If we do not like it, there is nothing to hold those people together. And where this situation arises, there is no way of forcing an agreement where it is not voluntary. So little by little, facts take away the sting of things. Because facts have, there's no reason why facts should ever offend us. The only reason that a fact can offend us is the fact that we are not strong enough to stand the fact. We should never be hurt by truth. We should never be hurt by realities. If we are hurt by realities, then we are not big enough to accept them. Realities are not wrong, but we have a wrong attitude toward them. So whatever is, that must be as it is. And we must associate with it in as easy and pleasant and relaxed a manner as possible. Now, it usually happens that any person who has any real consciousness in his own nature, wandering around through society, develops opportunities in which he can be helpful. This is a more or less satisfying state of affairs. We are usually more self-forgetting, which is very important, when we have our minds upon trying to do some good to someone or something. So as we go along, there are opportunities in which we can use what we know, where we are actually sought out and asked for our assistance and our judgment. This is especially true if we are living rather well. If our own achievements show that we have attained a certain measure of integration, other people certainly want to know how we do it. Thus we develop outlets, constructive ways of sharing information. But it's very hard to get interested in the advice given by a person who is making a miserable failure out of his own life. Thus, if we are not sought after for the advice that we believe we could give, then there may be some inconsistency in our temperaments that needs working over. It certainly would be worth a second look on general principles. It's usually there. Now, the development, then, of usefulness, of value to other people, gets our minds off of what's wrong with them, in a negative sense, and into the channel of what we can do to help them. This is very often a constructive and valuable approach to society. Also, in general, we would like to advance society in some way. Almost every thoughtful person has seen things that need changing. And if the dedication is strong enough and the consecration is deep enough, probably something can be changed for the better. But here, of course, we restrict human achievement to a comparatively small group of dynamic people who seemingly are able to cause change. The majority just can't stay with it long enough. They get tired, they get bored, they get disillusioned, and they get psychotic. So, continuity is necessary for the achievement of a lasting good. The person must stay with it. He must plan it, he must build his own character to sustain it, and he must gradually gain knowledge of that which is necessary for the end which he seeks to attain. Lack of integration frequently arises, therefore, from lack of knowledge in some department of life. The person is not adequate. He's not a success in business, or just is barely getting by. He has very little security arising from his inner sense of knowing exactly what he is doing. Uncertainty and fear and this type of thing also will prevent integration, will prevent the person mingling with and meeting with other people on a proper basis. I've observed that many people are more interesting than you suspect. That's another problem of integration, in my estimation, is that we are often over hasty in deciding whether or not we wish to achieve any kind of balanced relationship with another person. One of the things that makes integration move is that it is interesting. Interesting things bring people together. Boresome things separate them. Interesting people draw people. Bores do not. The person whose life is interesting, therefore, is sought out and becomes a positive center. It isn't necessary for this person to continually flow in the direction of others. They flow toward him because of the interesting things that he is doing or the interesting ways in which he does them. If you have any interest in life, you will find that it will draw people. It will also give you outlets which are not neurotic. Many persons have a great loneliness and isolation due to the lack of essentially valuable companionship. And a lot of bad adjustment is just lack of friends, lack of people who take a little interest in us so that we can take a little interest in them. I know that a number of persons who have discussed this problem, some rather interesting people, have pointed out that so many individuals are just as afraid as we are to open an unfamiliar subject. They're afraid if they start talking about something that's just a little unusual, that you will be offended, or that you will regard them as foolish, or compare them to the gentle imbecile we mentioned earlier. Therefore, they keep their whole life and their attitudes and their words and their thoughts on such a commonplace level because they feel that this is the only way to make sure that no one dislikes them. It ends up by no one liking them either, because nobody really rejoices in dullness, perhaps except the dull person. He seems to have a wonderful time, but other people do not enjoy it. Therefore, there are ways in which very often you can open a situation. If, for instance, in your home or wherever you happen to run across a situation, you either have something of symbolic significance by which another person can know how to reach you. It can often make a tremendous bridge between people who have otherwise so little to form an opening wedge of contact. No one wants to make a mistake in these things. You may have been studying reincarnation all your life, but you go to some stranger's home who apparently has no interest in the subject, and you hesitate, quite properly, from beginning a long and earnest discourse on the subject. You say to yourself, I wonder if he's a Seventh-day Adventist. I wonder if he's a Mormon or an atheist. What is he? Is he going to think I'm crazy? And on the danger of that particular situation, we are very reticent. But if this person are somewhere around where you can see it, some object, something which indicates that their mind might be of the same interest as your own, this is a hook you can take hold of. I know of several cases where this has actually worked. In a home of a person who's not at all generally regarded as interested in any deep subject, just a rather status-seeking individual, as far as everyone else knew, one, you know, trying to adjust to everybody's point of view, which is a very hard job and rather rewardless. I happened to notice a very beautiful Siamese painting, small, but evidently chosen with great care, great thoughtfulness. It was a nice thing. And in a very few moments, we had a subject in common, Siamese art. And it wasn't long before I began to find out what the man really thought. And it was entirely different from the thing that his bridge-playing associates ever heard of. But it was there. But if he hadn't left a little symbol somewhere, you might have known him for 10 years and never have thought of trying to talk to him about Siamese art. And he would never have brought it up, because he wouldn't assume you were interested. So these doors and barriers are often just plain blanks. There are very dull people in this world, but not as many of them as many people think. The dull person is a retiring, reticent person who perhaps has been offended or hurt, who just decides to keep quiet, study quietly when there's no one else around, and as one person I know did, lock all the books in the bottom of a trunk every night. He just didn't want to be caught with them for fear they'd be hurt some more. Not the books, the individual. But when this person found out that someone else was interested, it opened up immediately. and in this definite desire to be normal. Many people lock out and lock up their own interests. They're just afraid to be regarded as eccentric. Now, you might not think this is much more than brutal cowardice, but it really is a little more serious and tragic even than that. These people, particularly if they are breadwinners, if they're working in some conservative industry, if they're working for some hard-headed employer, one breath of nonconformity and their futures would be seriously hazarded. So they're afraid. They are afraid that they will lose their survival means. And to protect this, they have tried to become normal by utter and complete conformity. There are millions of people with this situation locked up in them in this country. They're just afraid, just as afraid as they would be to go to work in a sports shirt. Everything demands conformity. And this type of thing is very hard on a person who perhaps is a little lonely and is a little serious and never has a chance to express it. So it's interesting sometimes in trying to change your belief about how foolish most people are to watch for symbols of some interest, and also to make sure that somewhere in your way of life there are a few symbols that other people can sense or see or discover, and which will open them up or will make them suspect that you will not ridicule their thinking. On this pattern, you'd be surprised at how many doors opened and how much more valuable our friends suddenly become. There are actual cases in which people have been students of philosophy for half a lifetime, and most of the members of their own family never knew it. They have done everything so secretly to avoid criticism, because perhaps the marriage partner was opposed, that there was no real sympathy in these lives. And this person struggling on to try to be a better person, try to do something worthwhile, was just simply forced to labor in the darkness of the uttermost secrecy and almost conspiracy to nourish the needs of their own inner lives. If you can break through a lot of these things, you'll be surprised what you find sometimes. And of course, there is a world of common sense, of just old-fashioned, good, real, practical thinking under the surface of many people's lives, but they just do not dare to express it or have no reason to do so. In attempting to integrate, therefore, take into consideration a little more thorough thought about what you're integrating with. Make sure that you really understand this world, that you are not merely playing as others play, that it's a game of masks with everybody presenting a false face, no one daring to show their own features. And if we can get through this situation, we will discover perhaps not normalcy, but we will discover that the average isn't always just what it seems to be, that there are many things in life that are far more interesting than we are even willing to admit that they are. Because we finally build an attitude that nothing is worthwhile and everybody's rather foolish, and then we settle down and nurse our own disillusionments. These things do not lead to integration either. Now, how should we tell primarily if a person is integrated? Let's assume that we have some kind of a rule by which we can say this person has adjusted themselves. Well, obviously, the first evidence of true integration is that the person is in control of his own actions and his own thoughts. The integrated person is able to relax and is therefore able to meet problem with organization rather than tension. A really integrated person has only rare interludes of tension. We cannot say that anyone can be completely without any tension. This is almost more than we can assume of a nervous system that is as subtly integrated as man's nervous system happens to be. Therefore, we must assume that once in a while we'll be impatient. Occasionally we will worry. And maybe once or twice in a long while, we will allow a critical or negative word that we don't really want to say to slip out. These things will happen. But the integrated person is one in which these lapses away from organization are rare. And the one who is not integrated is the one in which any kind of a proper attitude is rare. The integrated person, therefore, is not wasting energy. He is not wasting the life within him. Nor is he moving against obstacles that are so obviously beyond his control and his ability that he can only pound his head against them. It is important for people to know what they can do. Make sure that they're doing it. And also perhaps to realize that there are certain things that it's not likely they will be able to do for a long time to come. And against these things, take a proper attitude and not simply rush in and force unpleasant situations where you cannot control the results. So integration simply means a measure of ourselves, an integrating of our resources, the ability to meet problems with poise, and the ability to use the best and all of our faculties at any time that the need arises, without prejudice and opinion and deceit of ourselves. It is the ability to be free from trying to confuse our own minds. Hiding behind opinion or prejudice or intolerance is simply a statement of defeat. It means that we can't solve a thing, so all we can do is hurt it. Thus, integration is kindly, is just, and represents a recognition of value. We come back now to the person we mentioned earlier, who has certain religious light or leading, by means of which he is able to face problems. The person who has understood his own psyche adequately has this kind of leadership in himself. For one thing, he knows that on many occasions he can trust himself. This is a far more vital discovery than to discover that we cannot trust someone else. We cannot always depend upon our own attitudes. We cannot think that a thought is important just because we think it, any more than we can say a child is truly bright just because it is our child. We might hope it is. We can develop a glamour that will justify our thinking so. But this doesn't make it true to anyone but ourselves. So if we do not overestimate the importance of our own attitudes, where these attitudes are obviously untrained, we also escape pressures. I've known several instances in which serious psychological difficulties came simply to a person who was bluffing. Now, we all bluff a little. We all like to feel that we can convince other people of our abilities, whether we have them or not. And I know people who have used bluffing to exaggerate the authority of their opinions world without end. But a bluff is a dangerous thing. A bluff creates tension. Because the moment we try to assume something we are not, we are thrown onto a highly defensive position. I know a man who got employment in one of our large airplane factories. Actually, he was not qualified for the job. But he bluffed. They asked him if he had certain experience in architectural engineering. He said yes. He'd never had a day of experience in it. But he was a rather clever chap. So as soon as he landed the job, he watched the people around him who were in the same job. He was part of a battery of engineers. He went one way or another, inveigled a little information out of one or a little insight out of another. He worked it around so that for several months he was able to keep the job. And no one for a moment suspected that he had had no training. The crisis came when, after about a year's employment, they wanted to promote him in the department. Now, he'd been living day by day expecting to be thrown out. The idea of promotion was the final blow. He couldn't stand any more of it. So he retired. He resigned the job. He was never caught. But the pressure built up. And if he had stayed even in the job another 6 months, he probably would have had a nervous breakdown. The fear, which was almost a guilt. The sensing that he was never quite adequate. The recognition that any moment someone who really knew would come along and ask him the question that he couldn't answer. That someone would check his record and find out that he was untrained. These things hung over his head like the sword of Damocles. And he was gradually going into a serious neurosis, simply trying to bluff. Now, many people, to some degree, do the same thing, perhaps not to this extent. But wherever we try to be what we are not, claim virtues we do not practice, claim knowledge we don't possess, we are constantly on the defensive. And this is another way to destroy our own psychic integration. If in the course of a reasonable amount of study, we can begin to get our values straight, if we can spend a certain amount of time in contemplative exercise. Now, contemplative exercise does not mean hatha yoga. Contemplative exercise simply means the building of the abstract patterns of life, the archetypes upon which we must depend for motivation. If we enrich ourselves culturally, if we give a certain amount of serious attention to forms of knowledge which contribute to our internal peace of mind and the organizing of our psychic resources, if we gradually develop a better philosophy of life, if we turn to one or two good sources of instruction and benefit from this instruction, not because we accept everything we are told, but because we gradually reach a sense of internal adequacy. We have at least working answers. At least we have reasonable reasons for what we think and do. And these develop little by little until they become also guides to the next things that we do. If we, for instance, we can gradually put a universe of law and order together in our own consciousness, we can get rid of the ideas of miracles and of accidents and of coincidences and begin to see the dimensions of a merit system arising in space around us. If we gradually put the universe into an ethical relationship to living things, little by little, we begin to mature a sense of honesty, of integrity in our own lives. So through the enrichment of our culture, through the study of great basic thoughts, through appreciation for the true creativity that has given us what is good in our world, we slowly develop a strong inner life. An inner life that we don't have to constantly fall back upon in the sense of running away and hiding in it, but an inner life that is placid, that has a fairly adequate answer in itself for the common questions of the day. We don't have to wonder all the time. Some of this wondering we can put in order immediately. We do not have to be catered to. We don't demand it any longer. We don't have to be agreed with. It doesn't mean anything. Little by little, our philosophy of life makes foolish things seem just as foolish as they are, and makes wise things reveal their own wisdom clearly and obviously and honestly. So we get away from pretenses. We don't admire it. We no longer need it. And when we do not need falsehood, we won't be problemed or plagued with its consequences. So integration, it seems to me, even integration socially, means a person who gradually reaches a state of poise. A poised person is one who is sufficient to his needs, who moves through society in a gentle, strong manner, self-contained in the sense that he has no dependency upon the whims of others, but not aloof in the sense of being uninterested in others. Not sophisticated in any sense of the word, but bestowing a certain sense of ease because situations do not fluster or upset him. He is sufficient for them. He can win or lose an argument or a discussion with the perfect happiness of spirit. He doesn't have to win. He is not fighting to win. He is simply fighting to be himself, to be a true person, regardless of whether he wins or not. So we have poised people. And we get to this situation. It's interesting that society reacts. One of the most interesting phases of integration is what it does in preventing others from imposing upon us. The person who is integrated is given a strange but subtle kind of respect. There is a certain recognition. When a person comes into an association or an assembly of people who is obviously always going to be equal to the emergency, whose graciousness, whose poise, whose natural but not assumed dignities are such that he wins respect, he will not be treated cheaply. He will not be imposed upon, and he will not be the victim of the conspiracies of others. Thus, the integrated person has a certain wall around himself, a wall through which every good and kindly thing can pass through 1,000 doorways, but a wall which will not encourage other persons to impose upon him. We impose upon people we think we can deceive. If we sense that we cannot deceive this person, we will not try. Or if we do try, we will go very short distance before we are discouraged. If we know that this person is not going to be angry, we don't try to anger him. If we know that he won't argue, we don't argue with him. If we know that he is not going to be intolerant or support any prejudice that is unreasonable, we're not going to plague him with them. Because when we try to sell a falsehood to someone else, we need a buyer. And if the other person is not a buyer, and we know it, we will not bother with the sales talk. So when we sense intelligence, we do not impose upon it for the most part. The person is certainly protected against a large part of imposition. If we know a person is going to say yes or no and mean it, we will only ask such questions as we hope will receive a favorable answer. We are not going to impose because we know we cannot. Yet at the same time, this person may be entirely gracious and willing to render all reasonable assistance at any time. Thus, the person who is integrated does radiate an atmosphere. The person who has adjusted adequately to life is recognized as such. People who have no idea what adjustment is will realize that this person has it, whatever it is. Individuals in every walk of life will therefore refrain from involving such a person in a situation that is unfortunate or embarrassing because they know it is useless. No one will try to sell him phony oil stock because they know he won't buy. They know he isn't foolish. Therefore, they won't try to over-influence him. They won't expect him to conform with foolishness because they know he isn't foolish. They don't expect him to wear outlandish clothes. They don't expect him to be a status seeker because they already know that he's a real person. And this in its own turn brings a relationship with other people that is far more comforting than the brittle efforts that we so often make. So integration within ourselves certainly does create better relations with everyone around us. The only problem that most people suffer from is that they learn to integrate too late. They do not achieve it until too many problems have gone beyond ordinary correction. If we have been an easy mark for 50 years, it's difficult to change in our gray hairs. If we have followed or if we have supported imposition for a half a lifetime and then suddenly we refuse to any longer, there is a major crisis in our affairs. Actually, from our schooling years on, we should be taught the clear, direct acceptance of real responsibility and the unwillingness to accept imposition at any time for any reason. If we could start out earlier in life with these realizations, we would have many clear and relaxed hours that are now spent walking the floor, trying to extricate ourselves from a series of previous compromises we should never have gotten into. So integration cannot start too soon. Whenever it appears, we need it. And we need it as fast as we can get it. To our way of thinking, philosophy leads as an integrating power. We think of Plato as an integrated human being. We think of Socrates as one. Socrates was not a conformist, but he was a person whose nonconformity we respect because we know that it arose from great insight and from a tremendous unselfishness that was far more real and more wonderful than any of the little minor offenses that he may have committed in the name of common sense. We know the dignity and majesty of Plato's mind. We realize the graciousness of it. We know that we can't all be Plato's. But we do also recognize the fact that we can also strengthen or deepen a philosophy of life that it will help us to keep this poise, to keep this rightness of things. For the moment we begin to impose our own rightness upon life, the moment we move serenely and rightly in the pattern of our own existence, we become an important constructive factor in the environment of other people. Then we are contributing to a normal world. We are giving other people who are also seeking bridges something to be considered normal. Our better conduct can also become within the pattern of someone else's adjustment to normalcy. The real normal individuals of history are those who have not just conformed, because it is not normal for man to conform only. Man is a creating being. Man is a thinking being. He is a reasoning, inventing being. Conformity is simply acceptance of defeat. On the other hand, violent nonconformity is a dangerous thing for the average person. But to outgrow conformity without violating it, to gradually rise to an individuality that becomes more significant than conformity, this can be done. And the person who has his little economic problem trying to think it through may also find that he can be a more interesting person, so that he is accepted now because he is a thinker, rather than the fact that he was accepted before because he agreed with someone else. People like to be agreed with, but in these days of intense competition, these same people prefer to employ someone who has ideas. And the person who has great ideas usually will survive even in an economic pressure. I was talking to a man not long ago who has a very large agency dealing with creative problems, ideas in business. And he said, you know, for many years I took the attitude that I knew what was best. And when a man said to me, you're wrong, I fired him. In the last few years, I've made a discovery. Now when a man says to me, you're wrong, I say to him, all right, prove it and I'll double your salary. But you've got to prove it. Because he said, I've found the men who said I was right never contributed anything. I had to do all the work. All they could do was agree with me. And I learned the importance of hiring people who dared to think for themselves. Now this means that for this man, the idea of a normal employee has changed. A few years ago, the normal employee was a yes man. Today, he is a man who is able to compromise and say, maybe. Tomorrow, he may be a man who comes straight out and says, no. These problems are changing with the pressure of our time. But unfortunately, we're not producing many people to meet the changes. We are still educating millions of yes men. We are only able to produce occasional individuals who have the internal capacity for personal decision. Thus, normalcy would seem to me to imply not the average, but that which is naturally to be expected of man. Man has been given a brain. It should be normal for him to use it. He has been given creativity. It would be normal for him to exhibit it. He has been endowed by nature with common sense. It would be normal for him to show it. And it is also true that he has been given an individuality. And while in the higher measures of philosophy this may be a subject of some dispute, on the practical level of living, the individual is interesting, important, and really ingratiating because he is an individual. And the person who can't stand another individual is badly adjusted. If he can stand another individual, he is already on his way to respecting the power of each person in this world to make a unique contribution to life. So I would say that the normal person is the person who makes creative contributions. But the normal person is the one who lives as best he can, regardless of circumstances, whereas the average person lives by compromise. On this basis, I believe that social adjustment is essentially attained by a person who learns to know more about society than other people know, who understands better the pattern, the purpose, the reason underlying the social relationships of living things, and through greater understanding is able to steer a wiser course. This person, I think, is normal. And I think it is something that has happened within the last century particularly, that we have paralyzed those very initiatives by which we are normal and have made a virtue out of agreeing with the lower two-thirds of society as far as its levels of errors are concerned and being afraid to join that very small group that has always had to do the thinking. But for man, this is not normal. It would not be normal for a five-year-old child to dissertate on logic. It is not normal for a 40-year-old man or woman to simply conform with everybody else. Normalcy for the adult is that it be a self-creating, self-unfolding being, a person. And with this personal power developed and matured to be a reasonable, interesting, happy, adjusted, relaxed person, able to face whatever happens in life with a reasonable degree of fortitude and acceptance because he is wise enough to understand the reasons behind life and the laws governing human conduct. This is the person who I think is normal. And this person not only will be able to make a social adjustment, he can adjust to society, but more than this, whether he realizes it or not, society will make a real and desperate effort to adjust with him. Because society instinctively admires the person who is right and has the courage to do what he knows is right. The only persons who will not admire him are lazy people. They won't admire anything. But the normal person of this type sets an example of normalcy, which I think we desperately need in our world at this time. Well, I guess that's it.